get up and do my thing. I want to get into it, man, you know. Like, you know I'm the man, don't you? Can I count it off? 1, 2, 3, 4.
You're listening to the Church Politics Podcast with Michael Ware and Justin Gibney, where you can get in-depth political analysis from a Christian worldview. Transcend partisanship and political ideology with us as we seek true discipleship in the public square.
This is the Church Politics Podcast with Michael Ware and Justin Gibney on this Halloween week. How are you, Justin?
I'm doing well. You know me, I'm always excited to talk about a few of my favorite things, Christianity, politics, and the intersection thereof. But I had a pretty good week. We had a really good meeting or event the AND campaign did called the Church and Race. And so we had a lot of people out here in Atlanta come out, a very diverse crowd, and had a really great conversation. So it was a good ending to the week, and I'm ready to get to it.
That's awesome. So what did that event look like? You guys did it in Atlanta, but what was kind of the setup and the goal of it?
Yeah, so the goal was this. It was called The Church and Race, a tough conversation about discipleship. And really what we wanted to show people was that this whole conversation does come back to discipleship, and we're not going to get through it if we have chips on our shoulder, if we put our defense mechanism up. So what we did, me, Sho Baraka, and some other brothers, we really had a tough conversation. So we had about three speakers who did, you know, TED Talk type speeches. And then we had a panel of pastors, a mixed group of pastors who really just talked about their experiences and had that tough conversation. And it was good. You know, it was one of those family conversations, and in family conversations, sometimes they're not pleasant. But if you know where they're coming from, then you can appreciate what's coming out. And those are the kind of conversations I believe we're going to have as a Christian community to lead on this race issue, because it's well past time that we took the lead to heal the nation in that regard.
Yeah, and right, it's more than just getting people to, you know, parrot out the right talking points. Because I found just a lot gets hidden that way. What's really needed, and what I heard, not just from you, but I've heard from folks that attended the event, is you were digging under that a little bit and getting to some real talk, which I think is really important.
Oh yeah, we went in. We went all the way in. But we did it with the right spirit, right? We went all the way in. Right. But at the end of the day, we said you have to be aspirational. If you're not aspirational, you're not going to be part of the solution.
Yeah. Well, I'm feeling aspirational this week. I was at Wheaton, outside of Chicago. I did an event, was hosted by Vince Bacot. But man, if I could be on a college campus once a week, I think I'd be happier. I think I'd just be feeling better about things, because those students are just incredible. I got to meet one-on-one with some students. The students that attended my event always ask earnest questions, always ask intelligent questions. And I just had a real good time. And then, obviously got to spend time with Vince Bacot, author of The Political Disciple, which is an incredible book. Also got to meet Ray Chang, who wrote that the Christianity Today article that sort of played out the conversation that Lecrae and John Piper were having, and Ray's article kind of blew up. And so it was incredible meeting that brother and getting to spend some time with him. And he's the real deal for sure. So yeah, it sounds like we both had good weeks. We're both feeling good.
Yeah, the spirit is moving, and we got some things. We have a lot of work to do, but I feel like we're going to get some things done in the near future. So I'm ready to see it happen.
Well, you know, Justin, sometimes these transitions work a little too well, and it seems like someone might be not having such a good week coming up. We record this podcast on Sunday. It's reported that as early as Monday, the first charges will be filed in special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russia and collusion with the Trump campaign. This thing has blown up again over the last week, not only with questions that the first charges will be filed, and Lord knows if Mueller is going to file charges It means he has a pretty good case. But also the dossier has come back. The infamous dossier from the campaign that allegedly had significant dirt on the Trump campaign that potentially would open him up to blackmail. The dossier has come back, and it's come back because the people have followed the money and found that not just Democrats have funded it, and a lawyer that was associated with the Clinton campaign, but Republicans have funded it, particularly and reportedly Marco Rubio's campaign and people associated with Marco Rubio. And so, you know, we're 10 months into the Trump administration, 9-10 months in, and he has not been able to get rid of these Russia stories. And if Mueller indeed does file charges, it's going to be significant. Is this still a situation for you where it's like where there's smoke, there's fire, or does Mueller filing charges make it that way, or kind of how are you processing all this?
It's tough. It's a lot going on. So one of the things that you said earlier, which I think you were completely correct, is we've held back some of our opinion on this until we got the facts. So I'm hoping this allows us to get closer to the facts. I think that's the best way to go about it. I'm still trying to decide if that's going to happen or not. Now, CNN was the first to report that the federal grand jury in Washington on Friday had approved the first charges in the investigation led by special counsel Robert Mueller. But the New York Times and a few other sources said they haven't been able to affirm it. And they said that explicitly. So they usually don't say that explicitly unless they think this may not happen or there might be some information that's not completely accurate. So we'll have to see what happens. I'm hoping we're getting towards having some answers. As you mentioned as well, the Washington Post reported that the DNC and the Clinton campaign actually commissioned the dossier, which was basically a report that was full of Russian intelligence and maybe even misinformation about Donald Trump. So in that report, what the Washington Post said was that apparently payments were made via some law firm to an opposition research, or what we call Oppo research outfit called Fusion GPS. Now, this Fusion GPS group then hired a British spy. This gets deep. They hired a British spy who put together information that was received from the Kremlin. That's Russia, from a Kremlin connected group. Man, you're talking about a tangled web. This is getting a little bit crazy. The Wall Street Journal, rather, their editorial board had a fairly provocative article that came out after that, saying that, again, Democrats had paid for a report put together by the Russians, and then they tried to hide their role. So apparently, Deputy Wacherman Schultz, several of the Clinton advisors told investigators, or they denied that they knew anything about this arrangement. But if you look at the arrangement, the Wall Street Journal is saying somebody knew something and someone's not being as honest as they should be. So two of the Fusion GPS founders have actually invoked their Fifth Amendment rights to avoid answering the investigators' questions. So to answer your question, Brother Weir, this looks like quite a bit of smoke and it's coming from the left and the right. This should be interesting.
And, you know, I saw, and it's, you know, it's kind of been a little poo-pooed by some, but some of the reporters, including Maggie Haberman from the New York Times, who was the chief reporter for the Times on the Clinton campaign, she tweeted earlier this week that just her frustration that the Clinton campaign and folks associated with the Clinton campaign and with this denied repeatedly and emphatically with great sort of, self-righteousness that they weren't involved. And yet it comes out, you know, reportedly that Mark Elias, who was a lawyer associated with Clinton's campaign, you know, was involved. And so, yeah, I think we're seeing frustration with sort of the incredulous sort of misdirection that's been going on, like you said, not just on the right, but on the left. And, you know, all of this is obscuring the fact that,
you know, at its core is a real serious question of whether the Russian government has leverage over someone who is now sitting in the Oval Office. And so, you know, while it has all this sort of sense of intrigue and sort of DC game playing, the question at the core, like it so often is important, which I think is why so many people get frustrated with Beltway politics and campaign games.
Yeah, there's so many angles you could hit this from. One thing I believe we can take from all of this is that Russia is playing a serious game of chess, and we better get it together because they're not playing, right? They're very serious about what's going on. They've thought this out, and we need to get our stuff together. So we're battling. Both sides are having all this righteous indignation about Russia, sure. And they're both doing the same thing, right? Yeah. It doesn't make sense. And this is why people, as you said, they lose faith in our political system, because it's hard to believe what folks are saying. You make Russia this big deal, and then you find out your side was dealing with Russia in some way or another as well. The other thing that the Wall Street Journal pointed out, which some people are disputing, and they're saying that there's a targeted, you know, effort to get Mueller out of there that's really unfair, but the Wall Street Journal basically said they think that he should resign, because part of the report, I believe, that came out in the Washington Post or maybe another outlet was that the FBI might have actually used information from this dossier in the investigation. And if they, in fact, use some of that information in this investigation, then, you know, that compromises their position. Some people are disputing whether it's compromised or not. But wow, you have a politically motivated, you know, commissioned report, and then you have the FBI using some of this misinformation for their investigation. That would be a very bad thing. So we just, again, we have to wait and see. What we do know is that Russia is really trying to destroy the politics in this country, and that we need to get it together and find some type of common ground and start being constructive.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, we'll see if things clear up throughout the week. But Republicans have been hitting Mueller's team now for these leaks. There are people calling for Mueller to be fired. And if Trump does, in fact, remove him, then, that would lead to a whole other crisis. And, you know, someone who could be a central player in sort of refereeing this whole thing is Senator Jeff Flake from Arizona. And Senator Flake made significant news this last week when he announced that he would retire, that he won't seek his party's nomination to run again for his Senate seat. And obviously what he won't be running for his Senate seat. In his speech on the Senate floor that got a lot of attention. I just want to read a bit from this. Senator Flake said, "The principles that underlie our politics, the values of our founding, are too vital to our identity and to our survival to allow them to be compromised by the requirements of politics, because politics can make us silent when we should speak, and silence can equal complicity. I have children and grandchildren to answer to, and so, Mr. President, I will not be complicit or silent." He went on to lay out in pretty straightforward, bold detail how he felt our values were being undermined and our democracy was being undermined quite explicitly by President Trump. And he said that he wanted to free himself from the strictures of running from office and the political sort of calculations that would require so that he could sort of follow his conscience in his last, in his last couple of years in the Senate. Now, some of the critiques of this have been that, you know, Flake looked at the polls, realized he couldn't win nomination. And so he's trying to sort of pretend he's making a bold step, but actually he's just copping out from what would be a tough race. But it was a pretty similar to McCain in earlier moments this year. His fellow senator from Arizona made quite a splash with this speech.
He did. I agree with several of his remarks. One of his quotes was that reckless, outrageous, and undignified behavior has become excused and countenanced as telling it like it is, when it is really just reckless, outrageous, and undignified. Couldn't be more true. So he made a very strong speech. He made some really strong points. I have a little bit of pushback, though. And part of it comes from something that Roland Martin said today, and I think I'm siding with him a bit on this, is why quit then? Right? Yeah. I don't see, even with him and Corker, it gives you some independence while you're still there. I get that part.
Right.
But why not go out fighting? Right? Why not try to come back and try to make your point and go to your people in Arizona and tell them why what you're doing is so important? Yeah, you might lose, but if it's really all about making the discourse better, making our politics better, and making sure the principles that we're supposed to be living by and that have served this country well, if it's really about supporting those and representing those things, then why quit? Why not keep pushing? Why not inspire others from seeing you being willing to say, you know what, I might lose, but they're not going to take me out. I believe in this so much that I'm going to fight to the end until the voters tell me that I'm not the one to be here. I think that'd be a little more dignified stance, but hey, I don't know the complete circumstances at all. But I think that commentary that Roland Martin brought up, I believe it was on one of the more Sunday morning shows. Right. There's something to that. I don't see why you quit if it's really just a principled stand.
Yeah, absolutely. I see that. I think part of what I'll be looking for is the role that he plays in the election race for his seat. And so, you know, if a far right sort of a Trumpian sort of candidate wins the Republican nomination, is Flake willing to say, look, I have some strong disagreements with the Democrat, but the Democrat who's likely to win the nomination is more of a centrist. And if it indeed turns out that way, you know, it'll be interesting. In other words, you know, does he try to be a kingmaker in the race in a way that he couldn't be if he ran the nomination sort of lost and sort of his ideas were taken to be, you know, defeated in the primary, at least at this point, he gets to step back a little bit. But I see the critique. I think the other thing I'll be looking for is, again, will Flake, Corker, McCain, you know, I think Sass to a lesser extent, will they do more than talk? And what kind of, you know, between the four of them, they could really provide something of a fulcrum in the Senate to allow some things to come up for votes that wouldn't come up otherwise, to allow for some investigations to take place that wouldn't happen otherwise. But if all they're going to do is talk and let sort of the Republican agenda, the policy agenda they support move forward under this president that they think is undermining our values, then that's going to, I think, undermine Flake's speech and what McCain has done and what Corker has said.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And me and my cousin Jermaine were going back and forth on this the other day. I think it's great to come out and say all to expose all the things that Trump is doing to this country that are just destructive. But there's been opportunities to slow him down for a while. This is the first year. And so from some of those more moderate Republicans, I hear them talking, but there's been chances for them to slow this down. And he, you know, not that he's accomplished much already, but they could really make sure and push their weight around if they wanted to. And they haven't necessarily done that. We've talked about Ben Sass before. We appreciate some of the things he's doing, but I think there's some legitimate criticism that, but you have gone along with him on some things you probably shouldn't have. So that's a question they have to answer. I'm not one of those people that's going to say, well, if you didn't do it from the beginning, I don't care what you do now. No, get it right. Right. Sometimes it takes longer for people to get it right than others. Sometimes you make mistakes early on. As long as you get it right, I can respect you getting it right. I'm not going to hold you to. There's a saying that, especially in the law, the law never forces you to make the same mistake twice. And so I'm not going to hold people to making the same mistake twice, but it's time to step up. There are Republicans who get it. But I need you to get it with your vote. I need you to get it getting in front of the people and explaining this and saying, even if it means my career being over, I came here to do the right thing. And I'm going to make sure that regardless of what happens, that I'm going to take principal votes and principal stand.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess the other thing I'd say in Flake's defense is, you know, running a Senate campaign is like a you know, nowadays it's, if he was going to really make a go for it, for his seat, it would have been, he would have been having to fundraise every day. He would have been using other people's money to spend millions and millions on a campaign. And, you know, there is some sense if he looked at the numbers, and, you know, we can look at the numbers and see that this man was not going to win the Republican nomination. So you know, maybe it was just like, why waste all the time of campaign? Why waste people's money? Why waste my money to do something that isn't going to go anywhere when, you know, there is some real validity to saying, instead of focusing on trying to win a primary that I know I'm going to lose, I'm going to focus 100% on my job as a senator. And frankly, there are probably a few other senators who should make that call too. But I want to move on because there are two kind of Democratic responses to this, to Jeff Flake's speech. The first is Tom Perez's, the chair of the DNC, who basically shared a statement that said, Flake has voted with Trump 91% of the time. He's, you know, he's just as bad, and offered no sort of affirmation of any of Flake's words, no invitation to the voters who are going to be voting for who will replace Jeff Flake, that, you know, if you agree with Jeff Flake's critique of President Trump, then you need to elect a Democrat to replace him. Instead, it was this kind of like very bitter. Someone said it was, you know, taking the low road, kind of kicking Flake on his way out, when, you know, you would think a party that, you know, is out of power just about everywhere has a leading Republican critiquing the head of his own party, you'd say, yeah, you're right. Why don't you come be a good Democrat too? Instead, you know, Tom Perez put out, you know, a statement that I think probably distanced the DNC from a lot of folks who might be moved by Jeff Flake's statement to give the other party a look.
Perez is in a tough situation right now. So Perez, you know, unfortunately, when you kind of get, and I'm not gonna say he's desperate, but he's in a real tough situation. And you, a lot of times when you're in that position, you start preaching to the choir. And let's be honest, this is politics as usual. That's what most Democrats are gonna want to hear. They want you to go hard at that instead of being nuanced and really evaluating the situation about how this can get worse. And he's in a political position, right? He's not there to necessarily give a great speech that supports every angle, right? He's the political side of what we're talking about. He's in the party, you know, he's in the position that's more about partisanship than anything else. So it's understandable, but it's not helpful. And so I agree with you on that.
So the other Democratic response is by this Senator Chris Coons, who really has, you know, he wrote a really solid article for The Atlantic about how Democratic values aren't secular values. And he spoke as a Christian about how his faith speaks to some of the positions that he holds in the Senate and some of the positions of the Democratic Party. And then he writes in the New York Times in an op-ed called with the title, Why Jeff Flake's Exit Should Scare Democrats. And he writes about how he disagreed on Jeff Flake on a whole number of issues, but, quote, I consider him an honorable man, a loyal friend, and a valued colleague. His retirement is deeply troubling to me because he represents a principled and patriotic Republican Party, one that has long championed strong American leadership around the world, and one I now fear is falling apart. To me, that is not only a message of integrity and trying to speak to the better angels of even those who you disagree with politically, but it's also the politically the most astute response, which is to say, look, Republicans, your party's falling apart. Why don't you join us and push back some of the extremism in your party, and then maybe you could remake your party after we're done crushing them. this op-ed really gave me really encouraged me that a Democratic senator at this point would put his name behind something that was acknowledging the good in the other party, even with the political calculations that go behind something like this.
Yeah, he didn't have to do this. He didn't have to make a statement that complimented someone who he said in the article was somebody who he disagreed with the majority of the time. I think that speaks to his character. I think that speaks to how he views the discourse and the political landscape as something we all share. And people seem to miss that to some point. We share this landscape, and I may disagree with you, but if it's coming from the right place, once again, then I can appreciate what you're doing. And that's what I got from what he was saying. One of his quotes was that Flake's retirement is deeply troubling to me because he represents a principled and patriotic Republican Party, one that has long championed strong American leadership around the world, and one that I fear is falling apart. These are things that matter. He knows that he can get somebody from the Republican Party or someone from the left, or someone from the right, excuse me, who is much worse than Flake. It's important to point that out to the American people that, look, it can get worse. And maybe I said I don't agree with this guy, or I said some negative things about him, but I appreciate that he does have a level of consistency, a level of principle that we need in the public square.
Yeah. The closing words of the op-ed referring to Flake, McCain, and Corker, who we've talked about, all three of them in this episode, he said, we should heed their warnings, challenge them to turn their words into action, and ask how we can do the same. And that's just... that's a real strong message. I'd advise. So Chris Coons is a Harvard Div grad. I disagree with him on some stuff. I think some of his questioning in Senate hearings around religious freedom issues, I think we probably take a bit of a different approach there. But Chris Coons is definitely someone folks should watch. So we have one more issue to discuss, but before we get to something else that's going on in the Senate, what we want to do this episode was just this last week at Wheaton, I was asked kind of what commentators I listen to and what journalists I respect, and I know Justin, you get the same questions all the time. So we were thinking, why don't we just share, you know, three of our favorite commentators that we listen to. Justin, do you have any sort of additional setup, kind of how you want this to be helpful for folks?
Yeah, just based off what I said last week, which was that Christians should reward those commentators who are thoughtful, intellectually honest, and aspirational. If we want our public discourse to get any better, we have to embrace the thinkers who are being constructive, the ones who are willing to admit that everything isn't the other side's fault, and those who are thinking past the moment. Sometimes we get so caught up in the moment and so caught up in what Trump just said that we don't see the big picture. We don't see the principles that transcend what is going on in the immediate moment. And so there are some the writers and the commentators that I like to read are able to do that. They're able to see the bigger picture. Don't just listen to people who feed your rage. Don't just listen to those, you know, listen to people who critique you. That's something that does not happen. Listen to the people who critique you and critique your side and challenge you. That's always important. So if you don't have anybody, if you don't listen to or you don't read anyone who's on the opposite side of the political or ideological spectrum, that's a problem. And so we'll name some people here that I think have mixed, you know, are mixed on the ideological side of it, but that we can appreciate in general.
Yeah. Well, let's kick it off. Justin, why don't you go first? So name the first of your three favorite commentators.
Sure. The first one is probably a few ticks to the left of where I am, but I appreciate his commentary, and that is Van Jones. Many of you know Van Jones as a CNN political contributor. He's also an attorney. He's an author. He was a special advisor for green jobs for the Obama administration, and he's currently the president of Dream Corps, which is a social justice organization. Van Jones actually has a new book called Beyond the Messy Truth, which exposes the hypocrisy on both sides of the political divide and points out a way out of the tribalism that is really tearing apart America. And Van Jones, to me, is number one. Again, he's always thoughtful. He's willing to admit when he's wrong. He's willing to admit when progressives are wrong. And I just appreciate what he brings to the conversation. I don't necessarily agree with everything that he has to say, but I do appreciate what he brings. Here's a quote where he's actually, I have one quote where he's actually critiquing progressives. And he says this. He says, too many of us can deconstruct everything, but can't reconstruct anything and make it work. Too many of us know how to run a protest against the adults on our campus, but don't know how to run a program. That is a real critique. And those are the type of things that I appreciate from people like Van Jones.
Van, so Van was, Van and I were at the White House together, and he came over to meet with faith-based office to talk about green jobs. And I don't know if I've ever been in a meeting with, you know, government officials, like bureaucrats, that I left inspired. You know, I was just like pumped up after that meeting. I mean, the man is just a ball of creative, aspirational energy. He's something else to be sure. And his work on CNN has been great. I think my first columnist, so I have two of my three columnists actually just got new jobs, which is very exciting. I feel like it validates my taste a little. But the first is Jane Costin. Jane Costin has written, she was at MTV News. She's written for New York Times Magazine. And she was just named the senior political reporter for Vox. And so Vox is really sort of hiring a bunch of great talent, and Jane is the latest. Jane is someone, I don't know much about her background, but you read her writing and you know this is someone with firm convictions, but who is constantly listening in on other streams of conversation that is able to surprise readers, maybe even surprise herself sometimes with where she lands on an issue. And I've just really appreciated not just reading her writing, but being able to follow her on social media. She wrote an article for New York Times Magazine about virtue signaling and how we just don't believe one another anymore, which is like textbook Jane Costin for me, because it was a creative take that clearly showed that she was listening in on sort of the right-wing critiques of virtue signaling. And she had things to affirm in that conversation and things to kind of nuance from, you know, I think how definitive some of the conservative conversation about virtue signaling can be, and what that is and what it means. And so Jane Costin, she should be writing for Vox pretty regularly soon. She just got appointed again senior political writer for Vox last week, and so hopefully she'll get started up soon.
Wow, good stuff. Yeah. I'll be looking out for some of that writing. My second person is gonna be Damon Linker. Damon Linker is a senior correspondent for The Week, a great writer. He was formerly a contributing editor at The New Republic. He's a liberal commentator who was formerly, I believe, a social conservative. He actually used to be an editor at First Things. He was also a speechwriter for Rudy Giuliani. Again, what sticks out to me about Damon Linker as he writes, and I read him almost every week, is his honesty. He will take social conservatives, who he used to be, he will take them to task when they need to be taken to task. I don't always agree with his commentary, but it's principled, and I know he believes what he's saying. And at the same time, he will take secular progressives to task. He's more liberal than he is progressive, and he's helped me understand the difference between the two. But always honest, always a deep thinker in writing about the issues that really matter. And here's a quote from one of his more recent articles. He says, "Yes, many Republicans are ideological, and the party has indeed been moving to the left, to the right in recent years. But the truth is that Democrats have simultaneously been moving to the left and doing so with greater unity and on some issues more rapidly than Republicans have been moving to the right." So even through all that's going on with Trump, and he certainly goes in on Trump when need be, he also goes in on liberal or progressive reaction to Trump. And sometimes when they react in kind, he just makes sure that he's keeping people honest. And I think if you listen to someone like him, he is going to keep you honest. Again, you don't have to agree with all these people. You don't have to agree with everyone you read, but you should be reading people who challenge you. And Damon Linker on a daily basis challenges me, challenges his party, but also those on the other side. But also he has an appreciation for people on the other side, good writers, and was willing to give them credit and admit if he missed something. That doesn't happen too often, especially when you're playing a zero sum game or you're keeping points. You don't ever want to let in that you may have lost a point or that you got something wrong. But I think it's key to be able to do that. And it's actually helpful for the discourse and those who are reading his work.
Yeah, for sure. He wrote back in 2016, he wrote a column, Our Age of Political Discontent. And then more recently, he wrote a column, The Dangers of the Great American Unchurching, both for the week. And they're just columns I keep returning back to. I think he's a really important voice. But my second commentator is a more conventional, I guess, pick, and that is, you know, David Brooks. And let me tell you why I appreciate David Brooks. He made an intentional turn in his columns over the last few years because he recognized that at the root of so many of our political problems are problems of moral and civic character. To have someone writing from a perch like he has at the New York Times that is not just focusing on sort of the X's and O's of politics, though he will do that, and not just someone who's focusing on sort of, CBO reports and, tables. He is really getting at something that few writers are talking about, but that is at the root of so many of so much of how our politics plays out. And I'm just grateful for him bringing that perspective and applying a sort of moral understanding to the political and social challenges we face today. I don't always agree, don't always agree with everything he writes. But if more people were thinking about issues outside of just the data, as important as the data is, I think we'd have a more well-rounded public debate. I appreciate David Brooks for that.
I agree with you on that one, and thought about placing him on my list for one because of a book he wrote called The Road to Character. Yes. For all those listening, if you have not read The Road to Character, you need to read it immediately. He basically goes through the lives of several very famous Americans who lived very principled lives, even though, they all had their issues. But he goes through these lives to show how living with character is the best way to go about it. And I mean, that I've read it twice. It was a really good book. He did an excellent job. And he, as you pointed out, he's become somewhat of a moralist. And we don't have a lot of those. So he's done it without being self-righteous, right? I don't think he comes from a self-righteous point of view, but he does point out in all these things going on. And it's like I said before, the best writers can step outside of the moment. And so he transcends and at least attempts to transcend the moment to see the bigger principles and morals involved in what's going on. And that's one of the main reasons that I like what David Brooks does. Again, don't agree with him all the time. I know that he got a lot of criticism for his criticism of Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, where he basically came out and said, look, I thought this was a book without hope. And he had several different issues with it. I thought some of that criticism was unfair. I don't know that I agreed with the entire article, but, you know, a lot of liberal folks came out and say, well, how could he criticize this? How could he criticize that? And I never understand that. Number one, we all know that Ta-Nehisi Coates is a brilliant writer, right? He is a brilliant writer. But number one, he's not infallible. Number two, David Brooks treated him like a peer.
Yes.
And that's what he's supposed to do. Right.
Yes.
No. Why would he not? He would be doing him a disservice by treating him not like he's not a peer. And I think there's some soft bigotry going into some of the people who defend this. Like, he should never be able to criticize a black writer. That's ridiculous. James Baldwin, Martin Luther King, all those people got criticized and they did not avoid criticism from white people or whoever because they were tight with what they were doing. So I never understand the idea that a white writer can't criticize a black writer. No, he treated him like a peer. He acknowledged that he's a great writer. And by doing that, he can still have a critique. So I wasn't mad about that. I didn't necessarily agree with the entire thing, but I thought it was thoughtful. And I did think some of that book could have used a little more hope. So very good choice. I'm going to go down to my third one. And this is a writer who, you know, has really challenged me because there is some distance on several issues, but Ross Douthat, who is a New York Times op-ed columnist who writes about politics. He writes about religion, moral values, and higher education. He's actually a conservative Catholic, is a very strong writer. Whether you agree with him or not, there are very few people out there that can write like he writes, which is why he can be a conservative and be at the New York Times. He's quite a bit more conservative than David Brooks. And he does not hold anything back. I really appreciate his ability to spar with some of the strongest progressive writers, with some of the strongest liberal writers. Ross Douthat always holds his own. And I've seen him lose very, very few of those back and forth because he's a thinker and really tries to apply policy the right way. Now, I don't necessarily agree with some of his takes. I think they're a little bit too far right. But I've seen growth and I've seen honesty and I've seen the ability to hear other writers and consider what they're saying and say, you know what? I got to go back and change that. I've seen a lot of writers who've gone back and forth with him who at the end of the day had to be intellectually dishonest because they didn't know how to respond. Right. Ross Douthat, if you don't read his articles in the New York Times, you should. He usually has an article come out every Sunday and it will challenge you if nothing else. I'm guessing most of the conservatives that listen to us already know about him. But if you consider yourself more progressive or liberal, I would recommend listening to what he has to say. He had a great book as well called Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics. And I want to give you a brief quote from that book. And Douthat said this. He said, many of the overlapping crises in American life, from our foreign policy disasters to the housing bubble to the rate of out of wedlock births, can be traced to the impulse to emphasize one particular element of traditional Christianity, one insight, one doctrine, one teaching or tradition at the expense of all others. The goal is always progress, a belief system that's simpler or more reasonable, more authentic or more up to date. Yet the results often vindicate the older Christian synthesis. Heresy sets out to be simpler and more appealing and more rational, but it often ends up being more extreme. Ross Douthat.
Yeah, it's good stuff. I've appreciated his writing too a great deal. With all, obviously don't agree with him on everything, but he's really, especially his. I've appreciated his challenging of libertarian aspects of the Republican Party, and I think it's his Catholicism that he's part of the Reformicon movement that really sees it's a reason of existence to be how can the government through free market means but support and strengthen families. And that's one of the reasons why though she comes from a very different in some ways, a very different perspective. In other ways, she's Catholic. She supports, she's a pro family writer, and she was just named a columnist for the Washington Post. She must be, I doubt that there's been a younger columnist for the Washington Post, and that is Liz Brunig. And I have followed Liz for years now. I followed her when she was, I forget what piece it was, but she wrote something for The Week that caught my attention. And I just thought, wow, I need to follow this voice. I've had the opportunity to spend a bit of time with Liz. Liz and I did an event together at Acton University earlier this year. And now I'm very excited that not just, I'll be able to read her column, but that she's going to be exposed to, millions of people through her new position at Washington Post. And Liz is just someone who writes from steeped in theology. She's an expert on Augustine. I think very helpfully open about family life and balancing work family, having a work family balance. She really is insistent on policies that that truly help the poor, that truly support all kinds of families in a robust way. She's not shy about her conviction that government has a role there. But because of her background in theology, because of the ways that her faith motivates some views that are not always in step with any particular political ideology, she's always a great read. I always feel expanded after reading her, and again, it's just going to be great to have her at the Post. And so that's my third commentator, Liz Brunig with the Washington Post.
That's awesome, man. And I would also say we could probably do another one of these episodes. This is not an exhaustive list. There are several other people that could have easily made this list. You know, we could send out honorable mention to Nia Malika Henderson, Ryan Salam, Alan Noble, folks like that. This is from far from exhaustive, but we did want to point out a few folks who we think you should follow. And as church politics goes on, I'm sure we will point out more and more, but those are really commentators and op-ed writers that we thought would be good for you guys to follow.
Yeah. Well, Justin, I have one thing I wanted to sort of a shout out I wanted to give at the end of this episode. And that is last week, Senator Sherrod Brown and Michael Bennett, Sherrod Brown being a Democrat from Ohio, Michael Bennett being a Democrat from Colorado, released a child allowance proposal today, a child tax credit to be clear, these are researchers that Bennett and Brown have, allowed to analyze the bill. Some researchers believe that the proposal would cut child poverty in half. And the proposal is basically an allowance for children, for parents with children to receive pretty significant funds. So children between the ages of 0 and 5 would get $300 per month. Children between the ages of 6 and 18 would get $250 per month. Now benefits would phase out at a rate of 5% for earnings over $75,000 for single taxpayers and $110,000 for married taxpayers. But this is an exciting proposal at a time when, frankly, there's been a bit of, I haven't heard many exciting ideas coming out from either side of the aisle, particularly those focused on, supporting families, that this is exactly the kind of idea that I think is worth discussing, worth advocating for. Senator Marco Rubio was also celebrating earlier this week that his child, there was progress made with his longtime support for a child tax credit. And so on both sides of the aisle, you have, I think, a recognition that that there is a tax on families in this country, that there is a marriage tax, that families with children are sometimes disincentivized in this country. The last thing I'll point out, Justin, is Matt Brunig analyzed the bill, and he had a very interesting suggestion which was he just simply critiqued the he said he was you know pretty happy with the Bennett with the Bennett Brown proposal, but he had some significant tweaks, and one of them was he suggested the child allowance should not phase out, and the reason he gave was that the purpose of a child allowance, and I'm quoting him here, the purpose of a child allowance, among other things, is to ensure that when all families have children, their disposable incomes increase, all else equal. This makes sure that having a child does not dramatically reduce their standard of living, and so that they remain at least somewhat on par with similarly situated adults who do not have children. In other words, he's saying the child allowance isn't, it is part of building a society where we truly support families, where starting a family is not does not mean that you're taking as much of a step back financially, and so again, Bennett Brown proposal was released this last week. I hope folks will check it out. Vox has a very good article on it. Matt Brunig has very good critiques of it. I'm sure there will be conservative critiques of the legislation, but this is a conversation we need to be having in this country, which is, you know, what does it look like to support families? And I feel like that's a conversation that both sides of the aisle could play, have something to provide.
Look here, man, when somebody says that a particular policy could wipe out almost half of child poverty, it's worth paying attention to.
Right.
So that's the first thing I want to say. This is worth us looking into, worth seeing if it's real. Again, the child tax credit is not just something that Democrats are talking about. You have the Reformicons, you have Marco Rubio, who are talking about these credits, maybe in different ways, but there's certainly an opportunity here for us to have some bipartisan cooperation.
Yeah.
So I'd like to see them get to that. I also say this, though. So many of the dynamics in today's society make family life tough to achieve.
Yeah.
From the student loan crisis, the economic crisis in general. Health care costs, child care costs,
real estate.
And this is a pro-family policy.
Yes.
Right. This is a plainly pro-family policy. I like pro-family policy. Don't make it harder on people having families. And that's not to take anything away from those who don't want to have families or that don't have them. Don't make it harder on them either. But as you said, there is a tax on having kids. And so many of my friends, a lot of millennials say, man, it's just really expensive. I haven't even paid off my loans. I haven't done this.
Right.
You know, I can barely, you know, afford to live the life that I'm trying to live now. How can I include children in that?
Yeah.
It shouldn't be that way. And we have to make sure that our policy is mindful of family issues and the importance that families have in America. I've said this before. We cannot have a strong country if we don't have strong families.
That's right.
Because strong families create strong communities, and strong communities create a strong country. So we should be supporting this type of policy. Make sure we get it right, because you got to get the details right. But this is headed in the right direction, and I hope it gets a strong look.
Yeah. Well, Justin, that's all I had for this week. I'm just proud. You know, I made it through a whole episode without pointing out that the Buffalo Bills are 5-2, but you know, I'm just,
just lost that record.
Yeah. Right. is there anything you wanted to, anything you want to close out the episode with?
Not really. We will see you next week. I like I said, check out those writers that we mentioned today and those commentators we mentioned today. Check them out. Send us a note to for our Twitter handle is @ChurchPolitics. Let us know what you think.
Yeah, send us some of your favorite commentators. And I think, Justin, you're right. I think there are a lot of folks I left out, too. So maybe we'll have to do this again sometime soon.
Love to.
All right. Thanks, folks. This is the Church Politics Podcast with Michael Williams.
I'm grooving for the activists and graduates. I'm an advocate for those feeling abandonment. In the favelas and slums of ghetto inhabitants, it's like, can anything good come out of Nazareth? The only thing good came out of Nazareth.
This is the groove. Tell me, can you handle it?
I'm schooled in the ways of runaway slaves. I'm brave. I'm unchained. I'm Frederick Douglass with a fade. Oh, yeah.